This is a CBC podcast.
Support for delivery of this podcast comes from the Buick Enclave, the finest luxury crossover ever. Visit buick.gm.ca to see that where there's passion, there's beauty.
Welcome to the Dispatches Podcast. I'm Rick McInnes-Ray. This week, South Africa, so far. Brand new middle class, same old underclass. With its leadership in transition, we'll look at the biggest success of black rule since apartheid and its ongoing failure. The global trade in human bones, how grave robbers are emptying the cemeteries of India to keep the medical schools full in North America. And if money makes the world go round, the fabled Western Union Company is the choice of most in the developing world who send remittances back home. So why the call for a boycott? And soft honey Santa girls and a room at the Inn of Love. Christmas in Japan has a tradition all its own. This is Dispatches. And welcome to the program. South Africa is once again in the throes of political change. Divisions in the country's ruling African National Congress have been on rather public display as it gathered this week to elect a new party leader. But there's really no good time for a unity crisis in South Africa. In the 16 years in power since the collapse of apartheid, ANC governments have had some success as they wrestled with South Africa's economic demons. Parts of black society have been transformed, but most are not. For a look now at both sides, here's Dispatches contributor Rhoda Metcalf on the South Cape coast.
Under a brilliant blue sky in Cape Town's harbour front, a crew of fishermen prepare for their next trip to sea. They haul in never-ending lengths of bristly yellow rope with help from a wailing hydraulic winch, passing the time with loud off-colour banter. Watching them is a tall black man, looking oddly out of place in dress pants and a pressed white shirt. Although Patrick Munyeni can probably curse with the best of them, and he knows their work well.
I've been there as well. I spent some time out there at sea. On the lobster fishing, I was involved. Tuna fishing, I was involved. Up to the market side of it, you know. And I've really seen it all.
But these days, Munyeni gets his view of the sea mostly from indoors, looking out his office window, a portal between his old life as a laborer and the air-conditioned comfort of his new life in South Africa's middle class.
That's a good part of sitting in this office.
Is the view?
Yeah, the beautiful view, yes.
His office is nothing special, spacious, utilitarian. But the simple fact that Munyeni has an office, a senior management office, here at the Premier Fishing Company is impressive for a man who started out with a grade 8 education hauling fish. Munyeni has chipped away at it patiently, taking night classes, then management courses, slowly climbing the corporate wall. But he admits what gave him that final push over the top onto the summit of senior management was the powerful hand of the African National Congress, the ANC government.
I think if it wasn't because of the pressure, I wouldn't have been in a position I am currently and holding. You know, if I look back, it is really exciting to see a difference I've made to my life.
Munyeni is what's known in South Africa as a black diamond, a member of the emerging black middle class. Still just 12% of all blacks in the country, the black diamond community is nevertheless expanding at a dizzying rate, over 25% a year. South African companies now need to have either black owners, black directors, or at least some black senior managers on board to have any hope of winning government contracts or licenses for mining or fishing rights. The policy has fast-tracked ambitious blacks like Patrick Munyeni up the corporate ladder and into lifestyles once unimaginable.
I never even dream about building a house worth over 200,000, and today I have that. The affordability of educating my kids to better schools could that my family or my parents could never afford it. There's more luxuries that I have that I never dream about.
And Munyeni and his fellow Black Diamonds are not the only ones enjoying the good life in South Africa. Down the pier from the fishing company, crowds of shoppers and tourists are milling around the swanky shops and restaurants of the V&A waterfront, entertained by street musicians. The South African economy has not been this vibrant since World War II. Foreign investors, tourists, they're all flooding in. Construction is booming, car sales are through the roof. When the ANC took over 13 years ago, this economy was in the dumps, shriveled by boycotts, plagued by inflation. The ANC government turned it around, and they did it by putting a cap on spending, paying down the debt, and keeping business happy. It was an economic strategy that shocked many people, given the ANC's foundations in revolutionary socialism. But political analyst Jonathan Fall explains when ANC leaders shifted from rebels to state leaders, they had to win allies.
Managing the state and dealing with the economy in a practical sense dawned heavily on the ANC as soon as they ascended to the state institutions, dealt with a series of economic crises, a very distrustful domestic and international business class, and many people on the left would argue that government overcompensated by taking up an overly austere, overly conservative macroeconomic policy in 1996 in order to win the confidence of domestic and international capital.
It's been great for the rich and for the educated middle class of all races who are profiting from the opportunities of a glowing economy. But what about the people the ANC was created to fight for? The poor, the people shackled at the margins by apartheid. What did they get? On the down market side of Cape Town, in a scrubby township called Mitchell's Plain, one poor community of shack dwellers got 200 sturdy new townhouses last month. The workers, almost 1,400 of them, were Irish volunteers who built the houses in a one-week frenzy of construction. Munira Barron, a willowy 16-year-old who lives in a shack nearby, sits perched on a wooden plank, watching the houses go up and dreaming of a new life.
We never had houses before, and now we're going to have a roof overhead, and it's just great.
Are you looking forward to having a toilet in your house?
Yes. And with the water that runs, and we don't have to fetch water anymore.
You can have a shower.
Yes, it's going to be really nice.
Around the corner inside a big tent, the man who brought this project to life sits organizing the work. Irish property developer Niall Mellon came to Cape Town 6 years ago, just one of the thousands of tourists who come to stretch out on the sparkling beaches.
And I remember when we left the airport heading for downtown Cape Town being shocked and horrified at the sight of thousands and thousands of shacks on the side of the road. After sunbathing on the beach for a couple of days, I couldn't get this image out of my mind, and I decided I wanted to see a little closer what life was like for these people and who were these people living inside these most awful, desperate shacks.
Mellon's visit to a township inspired him to create a housing charity that's now the biggest in South Africa. They've built close to 4,000 low-income houses with both Irish and local labour. And their latest housing blitz created a splash in the local press. But it also raised the question, why isn't the ANC building these houses? South Africa's apartheid system, which forced millions of blacks and mixed-race people into makeshift townships, left 85% of the population with no proper home. And when the ANC took over, they promised, right in their constitution, proper housing for all. 13 years later, 10 million families are still waiting. And many are deeply disillusioned with the ANC, like Margaret Ndombele, who lives with her three children in a dark two-room shack.
Look at this. This is going to fall over us because it's old. It's a shack, it's not a house. And the children have got fever in winter because it's always wet and the water is coming from underneath. So many promises for so many years. We vote and vote and vote and vote and vote and vote, but nothing for us.
ANC officials argue they have spent money on housing, that they've built more than 2 million units, but the demand's too overwhelming. And yet, even the houses the ANC has built have been marred by bad design and bad construction. Keith Gottschalk is a political analyst and a member of the ANC. He thinks the government's mistake is trying to do too much at once, trying to solve the housing crisis and at the same time boost black businesses.
So instead of giving the tenders to the largest white-dominated corporation, it gives it to black building artisans who don't yet have experience in cash flow, in cost management. So time and again, the startup black companies will go bankrupt or they will build substandard housing. And thousands of houses have had to be repaired or rebuilt within, say, 3 months of being handed over.
And it's not just housing. When the government tightened its belt to revive the economy, basic services for the poor, their health care, education, suffered badly. Critics say that education for South Africa's poor children is just as bad now as it was under apartheid. Which is why many social activists in South Africa argue it's time the ANC find better ways to compel those who prosper in this new economy to invest in those who don't. The ANC is still deeply respected for its fight to liberate South Africa from apartheid. But a new generation of South Africans is now impatiently hoping a change in ANC leadership will liberate them from squalor. For Dispatches, I'm Rhoda Metcalf in Cape Town, South Africa.
And I'm Rick McInnes-Ray in Canada, and you're listening to the podcast version of Dispatches. We, of course, welcome your comments on the stories we air. Our email address, dispatches@cbc.ca. And you can hear the original program Monday nights at 7:30 on CBC Radio 1 in Canada. We reprise the show again Sunday evenings right after the World This Weekend, and we're on the web, cbc.ca/dispatches. Well, on a humid day in the Indian state of West Bengal, journalist Scott Carney got the surprise of his life. For months, he'd been investigating rumors of a macabre underground trade in human bones in the region. India had been a huge supplier to medical schools all over the world for many decades, until a grisly event prompted the state to impose a ban in the 1980s. But there were persistent stories that it never really stopped. In some parts of the country, it was even said, entire graveyards lay empty, and the locals living nearby could expect the same thing to happen to their remains. Well, Scott Carney was right to be skeptical, and he joins me from the city of Chennai in southeast India to explain why. Scott, welcome to the program.
Hi, Rick. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Would you tell me what happened that day in West Bengal when you were with the police officer and he opens the door of the SUV?
He opened it up, and inside there were these four, you know, sizable, hefty bags full of human bones. And the police undertaker opened up these bags and tossed them on the ground, and out rolled about 100 human skulls, along with femurs and tibias and ribs, anatomical samples that are being smuggled out of India and brought to the United States and Canada, and sold to doctors for medical study.
So the bone business is illegal in India, or only if it leaves the country?
Well, the bone business used to be legal in India since probably the mid-1800s. There was a ban in 1986 when a group of bone traders were arrested for murdering children and then exporting their skeletons. Since that time, 1986, the bone trade has been questionably illegal in India. Exporting is definitely illegal, but it still happens under sort of shady circumstances.
the incentive, I take, it's entirely financial. What does a single bone go for, or an entire skeleton for that matter?
Well, it really depends on the quality, actually. I've had long and intensive conversations with various bone traders about this. A perfectly preserved skull with all of its teeth would sell for about $5,000. And what I saw in Burdwan were about 100 skeletons, and those would be worth about $70,000. Now, if you have a really rare skull, like suffering from cyclopia or some sort of obvious deformation, or someone who is a victim of a murder, those skulls can be quite expensive. Fetal skulls are probably the most valuable. I think finger bones, you can get them for a bargain basement price of $50.
It's one macabre subject. What led you to look into it?
I've been living in India off and on for 10 years, and I've always heard about these bone traders in Calcutta. And, you know, many people had said that they were over, that it just didn't exist anymore. And I didn't believe them. And I knew that it was definitely still going on. It only took a matter of digging, about 5 months of digging, to bring the whole story out.
I understand it's not just the medical demand that's driving this business, so that there are uses for bones in other places for other purposes.
I was able to actually track one cache of skeletons on the Bhutan border. I actually crossed over into Bhutan and found a police stash with probably several hundred skulls that had been dug up from Muslim graveyards, bags and bags full of skulls. And what they were being used for were Buddhists in Bhutan who use them for tantric rituals. They'll you know, put milk in the bowls to give offerings to certain gods and use them as begging bowls. In Bhutan, you have a very different use for human bones.
You mentioned Muslim bones a moment ago. How does faith fit into this?
Hindus generally cremate their dead, so you're not going to have Hindu graveyards. Historically, it's been mostly the Christian and Muslim communities who've been the source for bones, and you'll find Muslim graveyards are the graveyards that are empty. I mean, Hindus also have their bones stolen basically right off the fire.
Police have plainly raided some of these operations. Have they ever prosecuted anyone for exporting bones or any other related charges?
No one has ever been prosecuted under any law in relation to exporting bones since 1985.
That seems remarkable.
It is a hideous miscarriage of justice.
So how do you account for that? It sure doesn't seem like there's any lack of evidence. Why don't these cases proceed?
The feeling is that it's just not a very serious crime. I asked the police officer, well, what if I just went down to the graveyard right now, dug someone up, and walked away with some bones? Would you arrest me? He said he would arrest me, but he wouldn't know what to charge me with. And the way he looks at it is as theft. What he argues is that, a dead person can't complain about having their bones stolen because they don't have rights under the law. And so who is really being harmed?
Scott, you went to a human bone processing plant, a rather primitive affair. What struck you about it? What did you see?
A tarp-covered bamboo shack with a couple vats, which would hold caustic chemicals in it. I was able to speak with some of the people who worked there. And what they told me is they would take bodies from local graveyards and they would wrap it up in a mosquito net and tie it in the river on both ends and let sort of fish nibble on the fleshy bits and unhook that fishing net after about a week and dump it in a caustic chemical solution, and then boil the bones and then let them dry in the hot Indian sun for a week. And then you'd have a pretty nice bone.
There's even a Canadian middleman or middle operation in all of this globally, I understand. Mm-hmm. How does that work?
It's called OSTA International. It's in British Columbia. They've been reselling human bones from India for quite a long time. What they're doing is actually legal. You're more than welcome to import bones into Canada. You're just not allowed to export them from India. So what they are doing is they're buying bones from middle operators, who we presume are smugglers, who operate out of Paris and Singapore. OSTA International is the only, to my knowledge, reliable supplier for human bones in North America.
You don't have to seek out a bone broker. I gather human bones are even sold on the net?
Sure. I just go to eBay and type in, natural human bone or natural skull, and you'll come up with probably three or four hits of a middle range, you know, middle quality human skeleton.
You know, if medical schools are driving this demand, they're doing amazing things with plastics these days. Can't they just get by with lifelike copies of human bones?
What you need is variation between humans, and replicas are, by their very nature, just casts of one individual, and you'll see one individual, and you'll go to the next replica, and with real skeletons, you get all of these variations that are available in nature, and there's just no substitute. No doctor would tell you that plastic is just like the real thing.
But again, if medical demand is driving this business, isn't it incumbent upon universities, institutes of higher learning, high ethical standards and such, to ask, where do these remains come from? How do we know they have never been obtained illegally? You'd expect there'd be some kind of, I don't know, code of conduct, a fair trade bones, if you will.
Yeah, I think that would be a starting point. But, I mean, the history of medicine is the exact opposite of that. We've been stealing bones from graveyards since the 1700s. There are not enough human skeletons donated. One medical school that I spoke to does use natural bone, but what they do is they actually split the skeleton down the middle. They just cut it right in half and give each student half a skeleton to study. All of the doctors I spoke to said, yeah, we heard something about India, but we honestly didn't really look into it. And I think it's a don't ask, don't tell sort of thing in the medical community, their dark secret that they've been keeping.
What about the public themselves, who have to realize in parts of India that the bones of their relatives are at some risk of this? Is there any kind of public backlash?
None that I've been able to detect. One man who came to this from this village called Amdanga, he told me that all of the graves in his village are empty, and that when he dies, if he gets buried there, his grave will be robbed as well. These people are very upset about it, but they also don't have much recourse in the law. I mean, India, although democratic, still does not completely provide for the underprivileged. And the Muslim community is really not taken very seriously here. Their complaints are not really listened to. You'll never get rid of it all, but what you could do is you could shut down the notorious bone traders, the people who advertise, the people who come on the internet and post bones. You could stop those people. Whether you'd ever cut it out altogether is probably not possible, but definitely the worst offenders are easy to catch.
Scott, thanks for your insights on this.
No trouble. Thank you for having me.
Scott Carney is an anthropologist by training and an investigative reporter by choice, contributing to National Public Radio and Wired magazine, among others. He's in Chennai in southeast India. And you can read his story about India's underground bone trade in the December issue of Wired magazine. If one of our stories puts you in mind of one of yours, we'd like to hear about it. Send us an email, dispatches@cbc.ca, or post it to Box 500, Station A, Toronto, M5W1E6. Well, in Japan, the Christmas rush is well underway, which gets interesting when you consider how few of its 130 million people are Christians. Without the religious overtones, the Japanese are free to define Christmas their own way. And they do trim it somewhat differently, as we hear from Canadian journalist John Northcott.
Yu Kondo and his parents trim their tree in anticipation of Santa's visit. Yu is six, and while a man of few words, at this time of year, he's got the basics down.
Santa Claus, Christmas tree.
The Kondo's Christmas tree is artificial, as are almost all the Christmas trees in Japan. Their size is open to interpretation, as his mother Kayo explained.
We got this big tree last year.
This is the big tree. This is about a meter tall, 1 meter tall.
120, I think. You know, the house is not so big, so this is enough for us.
While not all will have a tree, an increasing number of Japanese children receive a present on Christmas morning. Many get it next to their pillow when they wake up. When Santa visits Yu's house, he leaves the present outside the front door.
Probably we don't have any chimney up there, so Santa Claus gets here and Papa puts the present in front of our house. He can't enter our house without a chimney.
With a population that divides its devotion between Shintoism and Buddhism, less than 1% are Christian, celebrating Christmas in a big way would seem to be a bit of an ecclesiastical stretch. But the Japanese are pretty relaxed about religion, theirs and everyone else's. The Kondos, for example, were married in a church.
You have a wedding ceremony at church, like we did in a church, but we are not Christians. It's the same.
Do you have a ceremony at the shrine as well?
No, only at church. And we had a man for the church. How do you say the man?
A minister?
A minister, yes.
Although the holiday is almost entirely secular here, it was originally imported by Jesuit missionaries in the 1500s. But Christianity has had a tenuous foothold since then. It was banned for several hundred years, although small groups still worshipped underground. That ban ended eventually, but during World War II, all customs that had any American influence were best avoided. When the war ended, the Japanese once again embraced the more commercial aspects of Christmas, just in time for them to rise to become the world's second largest economy. While the Kondo family continues to quietly hang lights and baubles, it's a different story in the commercial parts of town. There's no snow on the ground, but the city is in the grip of Christmas fever. Perhaps it's their love of detail and decoration and gift-giving. Gifts are given in business and for special occasions. Even returning vacationers are expected to bring carefully wrapped cookies or candy back for their co-workers. Whatever the explanation, here in the department stores, Christmas is big. There are dozens of different kinds of trees, scores of Santas, large and small, inflatable Santas, Santa candies, plush Santas, even little crystal Santas, and chocolates, wreaths, flowers, and cascades of lights. But as with everything else, the Japanese adopt the traditions of others on their own terms. How many retailers in your neighborhood mall offer a full array of sexy Santa-style outfits for your favorite elf? White-trimmed red velvet teddies and bustiers with titles like Soft Honey Santa Girl or Noble Santa Girl. They're everywhere in Tokyo. For the younger Japanese, Christmas, and in particular Christmas Eve, is really more like Valentine's Day. There's dinner out with that special someone and then straight to the local love hotel where, for the equivalent of $50, you can rent a room for 4 hours of seasonal consummation, jacuzzi, and mood lighting included. Still, everyone we talk to claim to be only going to parties. This man looks forward to a party and just a small present.
Presento desu ka? Presento wa tontai no presento.
But people were less certain when asked what all the fuss was really about. The question, who is Jesus, had them flummoxed.
Jesus, dare no desu ka? Jesus.
Jesus.
Okarimashita, demo Jesus, dare no desu ka?
Jesus.
Cristo, dare no desu ka?
Cristo.
No one I talked to had a clue about what lies at the heart of the Western celebration of the holiday. While Christmas Eve is big for some and Christmas morning is greeted by happy children, the day itself is not such a big deal here. The stores are open and most go to the office as usual. The really big celebration at this time of year is New Year's, where they'll line up for hours to visit their neighborhood shrine and then take the whole week off. But for now, back at the Kondos, Yu is focusing on his wished-for Christmas present in a catalog.
Gundam desu ka?
Gundam.
He wrote a letter and held it up to the sky so Santa could read it. Yu is quite certain that Santa can read Japanese even from a distance.
Santa ni otegaki, otegami.
For dispatches, I'm John Northcott in Tokyo.
He'll find us someday, but I hope it's going to be later.
And I'm Rick McInnes-Ray in Canada, and you're listening to the podcast version of Dispatches, available on your digital doorstep every Monday from cbc.ca/podcast. podcasting. You can hear us over the air Monday nights at 7:30 on CBC Radio 1, or catch it again Sundays after the World This Weekend. We, of course, are keen to hear your thoughts on the program and your ideas for new ones, so drop us a line. Our email address is dispatches@cbc.ca. In 1844, Samuel Morse sends the world's first telegraph with the words, "What hath God wrought?" Well, the answer in part was a communications revolution. In a keystroke, the Pony Express was obsolete, and a corporate giant called Western Union would rise to replace it. But what goes around comes around, and by the 1990s it was eclipsed by fax machines and internet technology. But new management and a new wave of global human migration has revived Western Union. Its salvation lay in electronic cash transfers. And many of its customers are among the world's working poor who send their remittance money back to their families. In fact, in the Northwest African state of Mauritania, the CBC's David Gutnick stood in line with one of them, Mr. Aubry Agua, as he waited to wire money to his family in Ghana.
My name is Aubry Agua. I'm from Ghana.
And what are you doing here, sitting in the bank in Mauritania?
I want to send money to my wife in Ghana.
And so you do it by Western Union?
Yes, I do by Western Union.
So you're from Ghana. What are you doing here in Nouakchott? Mauritania.
Yes, I'm a businessman. I buy fish, that dry fish, and send it to Ghana.
Oh, so the fish I see along the ocean there in the sand?
Yes, please.
And what do you do with it? You package it and send it back to Ghana?
Yes, I send it through a ship and use shark fins. I send it to Hong Kong.
The shark fins?
Yes, please.
That's a good business?
It's a good business. If you don't have money, you can't do it, please.
So you're living here. How long have you been here?
Almost 5 good years in Nouakchott, Mauritania.
And so do you send money back regularly to?
Yes, to Ghana. I always send money to my wife in Ghana.
Because there's a whole lineup of people here from all over the place.
Yes. Everybody in this country trying to send money through Western Union to their own country.
And is it in little villages? Is it all over the place?
All over the place.
And it's easy to do?
Yes, it is really hard to do every day.
And it's pretty simple because I see people just in this lineup. We moved chair by chair by chair.
Yes, it's true. It's true, yes. Yes, Western Union is good for everybody.
Are there other companies that do it too?
No, I don't know other companies. Maybe some companies really try to do it.
But Western Union is the one.
Is the best.
So the $50 that you're sending back to your family, it's now 5 to 9 in the morning.
Yes.
When will they get that money?
About 5 minutes time. Yes.
Is your wife waiting at the Western Union?
Yes, she's waiting for me right now. When I finish and I call her, she can receive the money through Western Union.
And that's pretty important money for her, I guess. How many kids do you have?
I have 3 kids. One wife and 3 kids.
Oh, here we go again, moving another chair over.
We keep moving chair because everybody wants to send money through the Western Union, yes. Because Western Union is fast.
You're like an ad for the company.
Yes, I love them very well.
There's all kinds of people in the lineup. There's a very fancy people with jewels and fancy clothes and some workers too.
Yes, because here there are so many different countries, Senegalese, Gambian, Mauritanian, everybody is trying to send money through Western Union to his village or his country.
Oh, here we go. One more chair. Oops, excuse me.
You can use every language to send money through your own country. Even I can use French to send it to Ghana. I can use English.
Can you use Asante?
Yes, please. I can use Asante to send it through Western Union.
Oh, okay. One more chair.
$50. Trust me, Ogia. Okay. Oh, yeah, yeah. You will pay the fee. Deset me, Ogia. You have a problem.
So now she's got your passport?
Yes.
She's got the name of your...
receiver.
Your receiver?
Yes.
She's just typing in the keyboard?
Yes.
You gave her the money?
Yes.
You never get worried that money is just going to disappear? Something will happen?
No, there is nothing. Nothing can happen.
Ça, c'est le mot de passe 5. OK, bonne journée.
Thank you. So I'm now going to call my brother and give him the numbers. I'll talk to him in my own language. Yeah, bro. My son is kind of your NTG number now. 7387. I'll bring send it. Send it $50. Okay. And bye-bye. Yes, I finished. You can go to Western Union and collect this money.
And now where are you going?
Now I'm going to the seaside. I'm going to my working place.
Buy some more dried fish.
And do my business.
Bye-bye.
See you next time. Yeah, thank you very much.
Obri Yagua in conversation with the CBC's David Gutnick in the line to wire money at a branch of Western Union in Mauritania. Well, while he likes the place, not everyone using the wire service is wild about Western Union. Some even accuse it of exploiting the customer. In California, one group's even calling for a boycott to force Western Union to lower fees and increase corporate investment in the community. Francis Calpatura is executive director of the Transnational Institute for Grassroots Research and Action. He's in Berkeley. Welcome to our program.
It's great to be here. Thank you for having me on your show.
You've just heard that scene a moment ago from Mauritania. That's one loyal customer in that Western Union line. He says it's fast, it's reliable. Western Union's good for everybody, was the quote. He doesn't have a problem with it. Why do you?
Well, it's a tale that's told hundreds of millions of times around the world nowadays. It's the expression of love. Remittances is the expression of love of family members that has been separated because people need to have a place to work. And they go to places that have jobs in order to send money back home. Western Union, unfortunately, takes advantage of that love. It promotes a predatory relationship, in fact, with the communities that they do business in. They give the highest fees. They extract the highest fees. They give a lower exchange rate than anybody else. And that, in fact, they fail to reinvest in the well-being of communities that they benefit from. One of the things that the person didn't say when he sent the $50 is that his family member, in fact, will just receive about $42 of that $50. And it's the type of non-transparent business practices that Western Union and the whole industry, in fact, engages in that we're trying to prevent.
You are calling for a boycott, but this company, it's everywhere. It's global. Our friend in Mauritania didn't even know of an alternative way to send money, and there are other ways. Do people in many cases have an option?
Because of technology, there are more companies that have entered the fray of this $300 billion industry. And so there are options available to folks. People may not just know about them because Western Union is the biggest player in the industry that commands about 18% of the whole market. Currently in the United States, there are about 175 money transfer companies. So Western Union has the marketing muscle, has the track record, but they're not the only ones. And so what we're telling folks is until Western Union renegotiates its predatory relationships with immigrant communities in the United States and around the world, folks should use other alternatives in order to make that point.
Okay, I'm not sure what that means. How do you renegotiate your relationship? What are you calling on Western Union to do?
It's very specifically. We want Western Union to lower its fees, to provide a fairer exchange rate, and to reinvest in communities that they benefit from. Western Union, just like the money transfer industry, function like banks in low-income communities and immigrant communities around the world. Unfortunately, Western Union and the money transfer industries don't have the same type of regulation as banks do. Banks have the Community Reinvestment Act that pushes them to reinvest in communities they do business in. Western Union does not have such a regulation. So what we're saying is that industries, the money transfer industry and Western Union in particular, should lead the way in showing how it can be better partners in immigrant communities by reinvesting in those neighborhoods that they benefit from.
But that's free enterprise, isn't it, to charge what the market will bear?
We have no problems with free enterprise. We have a problem when it becomes predatory. A single transaction, even according to the World Bank, costs about $2, given everything, overhead, staff time, and the like. Western Union charges for the Philippines, where I'm from, $16 as a transaction fee and an additional $8 if I sent $100 to my family. So they extract, in fact, 10 times to 15 times more than what it actually costs them. Even the World Bank said that if Western Union cuts its rate by a third, it will just be competitive with the other its other competitors in the market. So Western Union by itself is really taking advantage of this expression of love of immigrants and migrants around the world.
But it's a bit like killing a golden goose. Why would they take advantage of their own clients at a time when they're actively courting them? They sponsor events for the Filipino community in places as far away from their homes as Dubai, for example. They'll come to the hotel and do business for you there. Surely you have to give them some credit for reaching out to that very community you're suggesting that they've ignored.
And we're telling them that that's good, but that's not enough. They have only investing 41 cents out of every $100 profit that they make from communities that barely make $15,000 a year. Even Walmart, supposedly this big bad company, reinvests $2.30 for every $100 profit that they have in communities that they serve.
That $50 our friend there earlier is sending from Mauritania to Ghana, it isn't a lot, but combined with all of the other people doing the same thing, sending remittance money home, it runs into the billions, as we pointed out. How much difference would it make to them if they were to save just a few bucks on the cost of doing it?
The World Bank estimates that, in fact, if the industry and if Western Union cut its rate by a third, it will have an impact on 33 million children who can be lifted out of poverty, because there will be an increase, a net increase of remittance flows to their families in the global south and families that they left behind. So it might seem small, but in fact, the scale of it is so big. It's a $300 billion industry and increasing 10 to 12% a year, that every single dollar that goes back to families who exist on less than a dollar a day has an impact on the lives and the future of children and their families.
So how do you tap into that kind of economic power in a way that's going to make a difference? You called for a boycott in September. How's it working?
There are currently more than 200 immigrant organizations around the country in the United States that have joined the boycott, and we just started in September 10 of this year. We're currently in every region in the country, and we have partners in Europe, in Asia, in Latin, in countries in Latin America, who are also feeling the same and having kind of the same vision of promoting sustainable economies on the ground, so that in fact migration becomes a point of an option for folks and not a necessity, so that people don't have to leave their families and be separated from their families just to survive. And that's kind of the vision that this emerging movement of immigrants and migrants from around the world are saying to the industry, that you could be a partner with us in moving that vision.
How seriously do you expect to alter the way Western Union does business?
We are very hopeful. And in fact, ever since we started the boycott on September 10th, we have received overtures from 17 other companies. And we're currently kind of in negotiations with those companies to sign an agreement that would lower the fees, provide a fair exchange rate, and reinvest a portion of their profits back to communities. And we wanted Western Union to be the leader in this, but unfortunately, they won't be the first ones to sign this agreement with communities, and we hope that they would follow suit very quickly.
You're asking, it seems, our customers like our friend in Mauritania to take a little pain. If they don't know about alternatives, you're just basically asking them to stop sending money for a while. How realistic is that?
We're not asking people to stop sending money. I mean, I know personally what a remittance means. I was a 10-year-old kid in the Philippines when my mom came to the United States to send money back. So people need to receive that money. What we're asking people to do is to look at other alternatives, and that once we sign these agreements with these other companies, that we would have certified companies that are pro-immigrant, that are pro-community and pro-development, and that's what we're going to try to promote.
I'm told a lot of the Western Union counters in North America and other parts of the world are really mom-and-pop kind of operations in corner stores and the like, just one of the many things that they do and sell. Isn't there a danger you'll hurt them more than the company?
In fact, Western Union partners with networks of payday loans, pawn shops, and so quote-unquote alternative financial institutions and communities. For the most part, that's kind of the agreements that they've signed all over the place and all over around the world. There are 325,000 agents. The vast majority of those are companies and are big institutions. They are not mom-and-pop stores. And for example, in rural Philippines, the places where the most extensive networks in the rural areas in the Philippines are pawn shops.
I'm told even before your call for a boycott, your group was looking at organizing how people send remittances home, other ways. Can you tell me a bit about what you're proposing?
Yeah, 2 years before we announced the boycott, we worked with immigrant communities around the country in church basements, in meeting halls, in union halls, documenting the type of remittance practices people have. And people engage in various types of remittance practices, both formal through Western Union and MoneyGram and the like, and informal practices as well, whether through the hawala system of the Somalian community, where it's really built on trust. And so there are various ways that people send their money to their loved ones. And what we found out, though, is because of the Patriot Act and 9/11 laws, that those alternative informal sources or informal ways of people sending money have been shut down by the banks and by the U.S. government.
Still are.
So, yes, yes. In fact, in the Somali community, both in Seattle and in Minneapolis, the bank accounts of the hawalas, Somali hawalas, have been shut down primarily by Bank of America. And so there's this effort to really root all of these remittances or the vast majority of remittances into the formal banking system or the formal system, of which, again, Western Union dominates that field.
Where do you see this all going in the end? I mean, do you just keep campaigning until the company perhaps pays attention or does something before it turns into a legal battle, or does it come to a lawsuit ultimately? What's the scope of your plan?
Well, we're already seeing the kernels of a new future. There are companies that are willing to sign an agreement that says we want to be part of a vision of a new way of doing business in the money transfer industry. And we predict that that movement of companies in partnership with communities is just going to grow. The only question is Western Union going to join this movement or not? It's happening now. It's going to continue to accelerate. And we hope that Western Union can be partners with the communities before too long so that they can be shown to be good partners with the communities that they benefit from.
All right. Interesting campaign. Thanks for talking to me about it.
Thank you very much.
Francis Kalpaturam is with the Transnational Institute for Grassroots Research and Action in Berkeley, California. Western Union, meanwhile, is on record saying its fees are comparable to others in the industry, and it does regularly support causes in its customer communities throughout the world through its Western Union Foundation. I'm Rick McInnes-Ray in Canada. This is Dispatches. And as the ideas surrounding this story came together, we were reminded of one we'd aired 4 years ago that tweaked it in quite a different way. We thought you might like to hear part of it again. It's by Wilson Lee, a Canadian journalist of Korean background, who was recruited for a Western Union TV commercial as part of its drive to reach a global audience. Here's part of a story about the changing face of Western Union and of South Africa, where we began this program.
I was having dinner with friends in a rather fancy restaurant in Johannesburg when I was approached by, yes, a very attractive woman. She said, "I like your look. You ought to be on television." I laughed, then I got cynical. "Nah, you're either going to ask me to pay for a bunch of photographs or you're going to cast me as some idiotic kung fu type just because I'm Asian. And I don't do types, sorry." "No," she assured me. "We're shooting a Western Union commercial for a Hong Kong ad agency and we need Asian characters," she said. "And we'll pay you 20,000 rands. That's $3,000 Canadian, which is a lot of money anywhere, but a veritable fortune for most people in South Africa. Well, I said, I can do Asian. I've been doing it all my life. It was at this point I asked what the creative concept was. A kid away at school orders a pizza, looks into his wallet, and realizes he has no money. He calls Dad, who's in some Asian metropolis, to ask for an advance on his allowance. Dad heads down to the Western Union office. Halfway across the world, the hungry and broke kid saunters down to a Western Union office to collect his money. The kid gets home just before the pizza arrives and pays for it with the cash Dad sent via Western Union. The funny thing was, they wanted me to play the dad. Ouch. But for $3,000, I was willing to play the damn kid's mom if they had asked. So they had me try on turtlenecks, blazers, dress pants, and accessories, all to make me look like a 40-something businessman dad. Similarly, the other Asians had been cast were busily trying on clothes, giving them all a cosmopolitan and hip look, even the characters who were playing the pizza makers. All of them were Chinese-African, but like so many hyphenated Asians in the West, they exist somewhere off the racial spectrum that's dominated by the black-white divide. But two loosely connected developments had brought South African Asians and the Korean Canadian together here: the end of apartheid and globalization. In the post-apartheid period, businesses rushed to reposition themselves on the right side of history by casting a rainbow of characters, especially blacks in commercials, lest they alienate the newly empowered black consumer and newly politically correct white consumer. It was a burst of revisionism in the spirit of reconciliation. And in that spirit, Asians, who had until then been excluded from the mainstream of South Africa, leapt at the opportunity to claim a stake in the most visible of ways. And more recently, with globalization, multinational corporations and their advertising agencies are searching the globe for the most cost-efficient locales to shoot their commercials. Many are increasingly choosing South Africa, with its multiracial population, urban centers that could be anywhere, a range of natural settings including deserts, jungles, savannas, and above all, the tempting combination of first world expertise and third world currency. And so I found myself among Hong Kong ad agency execs, white South African producers, black South African crew members, and Chinese African actors, all to make a television commercial. In the first scene, all I had to do was answer a phone call. In the second, I had to wait in line at a Western Union office and pretend to order a money transfer. These two scenes took all day. But I imagine people in Hong Kong, China, Taiwan, and Australia will be so endeared with a Korean Canadian and a group of Chinese Africans that they'll run out and send cash to their loved ones. And that's what can happen when the forces of history combine with the magic of television. For Dispatches, I'm Wilson Lee in Johannesburg.
Well, before we go, dip into some of the letters you've sent us about some of our recent programs. Our stories on the fragmentation of France and the impact of concurrence on AIDS prompted John Picorni in Calgary to write, "That's 2 days in a row you've shed light on subjects that made me go, by providing other perspectives or just filling in the blanks. Keep it up, please." And, of course, we'll try. On the other hand, Millie Baino in Ottawa writes to say, "I'm a Canadian of African descent and feel so tired of listening to your negative stories from that continent. Please cut down on your depressing reporting. Let the world hear about positive things that are going on in Africa." And we do hope we addressed at least some of that for you on this program, Millie. Then again, we got this email from Nathan Fahey in Toronto. "I was feeling tired and uninspired from making dinner. I turned on your show and it pulled me in, and I got into the cooking. Several parts put tears in my eyes, but it's important to know about those suffering with HIV/AIDS. Now, about our story last week from Bhutan and its policy of encouraging gross national happiness, listener Carol Farkas in Toronto writes, "It's a bit tiresome hearing endless info on this topic. I'd like to hear of the Nepalese and Indian road workers' gross national happiness, the lack of education for the children, the gross national happiness of rural farmers who need to walk days to get to sell their wares at market." And finally, Ron Vanderheiden in Caledonia, Ontario, on the program that builds houses for the poor to rent out in Mexico. "I just heard your story about how a modest guest house changed the future for Aurora Hernandez. It's a wonderful opportunity for Mexican families, but also for tourists on limited budgets. I'd like to know more about how to book a stay at her guest house or at one like it. And there is a link to the Tecos de Mexico website on our website. You can go to cbc.ca/dispatches and follow the prompts. Those are your letters with our thanks. And we leave you with mention that Dispatches has won the 2007 Amnesty Award for its radio documentary entitled The Paradox of Democracy, which we aired last December. It is the fourth Amnesty Award for stories aired on this program. And if you'd like to hear this year's winner, go to our website, cbc.ca/dispatches. That is our podcast for this week. Thank you for listening. And you can download it from the web every Monday from cbc.ca/podcasting. Of course, you can hear it on the radio Monday nights at 7:30 on CBC Radio 1 in Canada, with an encore presentation Sunday nights after The World This Weekend. Do let us know what you thought of the stories we've aired with an email to dispatches@cbc.ca. This program is the work of senior producer Alan Gattell, producers Donna Cressman, Donna Dingwall, and Allison Maceman, with technical producers Victor Johnston and Tim Lorimer, and myself. I'm Rick McInnes-Ray. You have just heard Dispatches. We'll bring you the world.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.